it's very different than the research I used to do with the bench with pipettes and rats and mice and gels. But this is really about listening and trying to get the universal threads of human experience. Right, it's the human condition and the neurological condition.
I'm John Fox, director of the Del Monte Institute for Neuroscience at the University of Rochester. I'd like to thank you for joining us for another episode of Neuroscience Perspectives. If you get a chance, please like, subscribe, and comment. I'm absolutely honored to be joined today by a neuroscientist and a New York Times bestselling author, most notably known for her debut novel, Still Alice. Dr. Lisa Genova is a master storyteller who transforms how diseases like Alzheimer's, Huntington's, ALS, Lou Gehrig's, and most recently bipolar disorder, are understood beyond the clinic and the bench. In bridging science and storytelling, she promotes empathy and is shaping how the public understands these diseases and the people they touch. Dr. Genova has received numerous awards, including the Sargent and Eunice Shriver Profiles in Dignity Award, the Pell Center Prize for Story in the Public Space, Global Genes Rare Champions of Hope Award, and the American College of Neuropsychopharmacology Media Award. She graduated from the top of her class at Bates College, where she also has an honorary doctorate of humane letters, and she received her PhD from Harvard. Lisa, it's fantastic to have you here today. You're on campus here at the University of Rochester during our homecoming weekend, and we have been putting you through your paces. So I know we were at a talk where you spoke to 1,400 people, a packed auditorium, and really told some of your amazing stories. So we're delighted to have you. We're proud to have you.
Oh, thank you so much, and thank you for that lovely intro.
Oh, brilliant. So I think what our viewers are really going to want to understand is how somebody trained as a neuroscientist at Harvard ends up being a famous novelist and takes that path, but blends the training in neuroscience into this storytelling Shanaki person.
Yeah, it's not a typical career path for the neuroscientist, that's for sure. And it wasn't planned. So how did this happen?
Yeah.
It was very unexpected. So my grandmother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and she wasn't diagnosed young. It wasn't like Alice and Still Alice.
Right.
She was probably in her 70s when she was beginning to be symptomatic, but we all ignored it.
Yeah.
We either thought it was a normal part of normal aging, which it is not.
Right.
And I think we were in a bit of denial because no one wants to see this happen to someone you love. And I think my grandmother was also just very... I think she had a lot of cognitive reserve in some ways, and she was very facile in being able to sort of navigate around some of the symptoms, and she was hiding it as well. Like, didn't want to, she wasn't a complainer.
Wait, when did you just, like, what was the first time you went, something's really up here? Do you remember that?
I do. I remember, I don't know where it was in the progression for her. I mean, I'm one of the younger grandchildren.
Gotcha,
she had 9 children. I was also in undergrad and then graduate school, so I was pretty busy during these years, but I do remember that she was leaving the tea kettle on the stove, and then you'd hear the whistle,
right.
And she wouldn't, I mean, her hearing was fine, but she wouldn't know what the whistle meant.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And that didn't make sense. She was leaving the keys in the door, and so we say, you know, Nana, your keys are here in the door. Where do these go?
Yeah,
I knew from my aunts that she was, they would say she's cheating at bridge, but I think she was just maybe forgetting some of the rules. So that was going on. I knew from my dad that she no longer handled the checkbook, that he was handling that.
Gotcha.
But that none of this registered as Alzheimer's. It wasn't until she walked to the bowling alley in the middle of the night thinking it was the middle of the day and then started calling all of the people on her bowling team wondering where they were.
Gotcha,
that the family was like, uh-oh, this doesn't seem like a normal part of normal aging. And so she got the diagnosis. And then, so I'm the neuroscientist in this big Italian family, and my background was in the molecular neurobiology of drug addiction. So Alzheimer's was not my area of expertise, but I'm a neuroscientist. The brain, like I can quickly understand what there is to know about Alzheimer's and pass that education along to my family so we can better take care of her.
Right.
And so I really geeked out on the neuroscience papers And that was lovely for me, but it didn't really help anybody in my family. But so I read a lot about the current understanding of the molecular neurobiology. Then I read about the clinical disease management, so prognosis and treatment and what we were going to see in terms of how this might progress.
Right.
And then books written mostly by social workers and caregivers about how to be a caregiver.
Right.
So books like The 36-Hour Day. So a lot of intellectual information. And I passed that education along, and it helped us all, and it helped me.
Sure, yeah.
To a point. Right. And then it didn't help. And so, you know, I'd spend time with my grandmother, and I was really uncomfortable around her symptoms of dementia. So she didn't know who I was, and she would ask to go home when she was already in her house.
Yeah.
And she would be confused about things, and she would she had these little baby dolls that she wasn't really pretending, as she was going to nurse these baby dolls, yeah. like to breastfeed these baby dolls, and she would behave in ways and be confused in ways that were just upsetting.
Right.
And as I was in my late 20s at the time, I would often get up and leave the room
just from discomfort. Like I don't know how to handle
it. I was so uncomfortable with what I was witnessing, and was so unfamiliar with it, and nothing I read had prepared me for how to be with my grandmother. And so I could understand her from a neuroscientist perspective or clinical perspective, but I didn't know how to understand her as her granddaughter.
Right.
And I was like, oh, this is interesting. Like I've in moments feel compelled to turn my back on my beloved grandmother. What happens when I encounter someone with Alzheimer's who I don't know? Right? If there's 55 million people in the world who have Alzheimer's,
right.
and what I want to do is, like, when I see their symptoms of dementia, is look away. Well, that's not okay, right? I'm turning my back on 55 million people who are vulnerable. And so I recognize that all of my feelings around my grandmother's Alzheimer's were feeling for her. So I felt bad for her. I felt upset for her. I felt uncomfortable for her. I felt heartbroken for her. I felt heartbroken for us,
mm-hmm.
bad for us. That's sympathy. When you feel for someone, that's sympathy. And sympathy, by its very nature of what the definition of sympathy is it keeps you emotionally detached, and your experiences are completely separate.
Right.
So there's my grandmother with Alzheimer's over there, safely different from who I am. Yeah, I feel bad for her. Whatever it is, it doesn't have to just be sorry. It doesn't have to be pity. But I'm heartbroken for her.
Yeah.
I'm upset for her. So I'm like, I didn't know how to feel with her. I didn't know how to be comfortable enough with whatever she was displaying to drop into her reality, to join her there and feel with her.
Yeah.
That's empathy. So like, for example, so if she had said to me, I'm waiting for my mother. She's going to be here any minute to come get me. What made me uncomfortable at the time is like knowing that her mother was dead.
Yeah.
And she had died 30 years ago. And so now, like, what do I do with this confusing thing?
I'm
so uncomfortable. Yeah. But empathy would allow me to drop into her reality. It's kind of a bit of improv acting. It's to say yes and to agree to the reality she's just offered and join her there.
Yeah.
Like, okay, you want to have a cup of tea with me while we wait for her?
Right, right.
Because that's the point. Like that she wants company and comfort, and I can provide that.
Right, right.
But so I didn't know how to get to empathy. I couldn't have articulated all of this at the time. I wish I knew then what I understand now. But what I did pick up on was, that's kind of interesting. Everything I've read is nonfiction and from the point of view of an outsider looking in. So a scientist, clinician, social worker, caregiver. I'm like, I need a novel. I need a novel told from the perspective of the character with Alzheimer's, because fiction is the place where we have the chance to walk in someone else's shoes and feel their lived, felt experience. I had tons of intellectual information. I needed emotional connection to my grandmother.
Right.
And fiction is a place where we can do this. So that was the aha moment for me. Like very sort of confidently, naively, then jumped to like, that book doesn't exist. So what if I write it?
Right.
And so that was what happened.
So it's a huge jump. And
yeah.
In the writing of that, so there's writing a novel because you want people to read it and it's an art form, mm-hmm. but there's teaching is a component to this, right? You did
For me,
this to inform people about ways to be and ways to think about the suffering and the...
The central question for me is, what does this feel like? And then also behind that was always, I'm going to tell the truth under these imagined circumstances.
Yeah.
So as a neuroscientist, I sort of put on my student hat and became a beginner. And it was, well, I'm going to learn how to write. That was a separate thing. But also, like, I'm going to learn about Alzheimer's. And my goal is, what does this feel like?
Yeah.
And what is the truth? So I'd already done the reading. So now I was getting in front of neurologists and shadowing them at Mass General. I was sitting in on neuropsych testing. Like, what does that feel like to undergo that day of taking tests?
So you took genetic the precision counselors. Of a neuroscientist, a trained neuroscientist to this task.
Yes. And then the biggest experts for me in that book and all of the books that I would write from then on, the experts are the people who have it and their loved ones.
So interfacing with patients.
I got to know 27 people living with early onset and or early stage Alzheimer's. Wow. And I was in touch with them, a lot of them, every single day for the year and a half that I was writing Still Alice.
And describe that. So are you getting on a Zoom with them? Are you going to hang out with them?
Well, now we Zoom or I hang out if they're local. Certainly meet a lot of people in person. But back in the day, there was no Zoom.
Yeah,
for Still Alice, it was there was a 1 hour live chat that we convened on every day.
Yeah.
There was an email group. It was through the Dementia Advocacy and Support Network International.
Fantastic.
That I found a lot of these folks. And it was phone calls and in person. So I am talking to people.
It's really a very different kind of research than a typical novelist would be doing, trying to figure out some historical context. You're literally out there interfacing with these people and watching their lives.
And it's the same idea in some ways, right? So if you're writing historical fiction, if I'm writing about, France during World War II, like, I had better go to France and see what's there. What are the sensory details?
Smell the rain on the cobblestones.
But what is the actual history there? I can't just make it up.
No, of course.
You have to know everything that's true and then leap off into fiction from there. So same is true for me. I'm not just going to write about bipolar disorder or Huntington's or Alzheimer's.
Right.
Like, let me learn as much as I can about what is it like to have, what are the symptoms really look like? And when am I, what does diagnosis feel like? What's the reaction in the room? And what happens when you then go home? And how does it progress? And how, if you've placed all of your value and your worth in what you do, and for Still Alice, she thinks for a living, right? She remembers and thinks for a living. She's a professor. And Alzheimer's is going to take that from her. It's a crisis of identity. Who am I now? Mm-hmm. And that was true for a lot of people. It's interesting. The title of the book comes from when I went through the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of email correspondence and notes that I took from conversations with people with Alzheimer's. The word still was in almost every conversation spoken or written by them. I still matter. I still love to garden. I still love seeing my grandkids. I still want people to see me.
Oh, gosh,
I still want to, I still want to participate,
sense of things
contribute.
Slipping away, but I'm still here.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's very different than the research I used to do with the bench with pipettes and rats and mice and gels. But this is really about listening and trying to get the universal threads of human experience.
Right,
it's the
right.
human condition and the neurological condition.
I mean, it's absolutely fascinating to think of somebody who's trained as a scientist, molecular biology as well. You're not in the sort of, systems, more the humanocentric side of it.
No.
And then you have to figure out how to write a novel. And I mean, talk about that. Did you have humanities training in your past at college or?
Yeah, I went to Bates College in Maine, which is a liberal arts school.
Right,
I took one English class. I never took a creative writing class. So this was definitely outside of my comfort zone for sure. But again, I know how to be a student. And I definitely had like a naive confidence. Like, I was like, well, I know how to do brain surgery, so how hard could it be? But it's definitely a different skill set.
Yeah.
And
how long was that process? What did it look like?
So I began by reading.
Yeah.
So I read books like...
Let me ask you, were you always a reader? Were you a fiction
yes.
reader? So this is part and parcel of who you were as a youngster as well.
Yeah. I mean, not even as a youngster, I would say. Like, I always enjoyed the reading assignments that I had in English classes
in
school. But I was a science and math kid. And I didn't grow up in a home full of books, like most authors will talk about, like growing up in these magical homes with all these library of books. I did not have that. But in my 20s, I discovered fiction, really, on my own terms and fell in love with it. And so always was reading.
Yeah.
So I read books on craft. So I read On Writing by Stephen King, Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott, Writing Down the Bones by Natalie Goldberg.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
So a lot of books on how to write. And then there's something serendipitous happened. So while I was being this sort of wildly irresponsible, divorced single mom, unemployed, writing a novel in a coffee shop, no less.
Turning away from a really good career in the neurosciences.
Yeah, like, what have I done? I was like, well, I'm just going to keep going here. I had always wanted to act. And like, you might imagine that the neuroscience crowd that Venn diagram doesn't really overlap with the drama kids. So I had never really had the confidence or the opportunity to really explore that. And so now I'm like, well, I'm writing a novel in a coffee shop, so I can do anything I want. I hooked up with a group of 11 other actors in the Boston area, and I trained for like 9 to 10 hours a week with them for the same year and a half that I was writing Still Alice.
Oh, wow.
And I acted in a lot of plays on stage in Boston. And I found that, and I didn't plan this, that acting really taught me how to write. So a lot of the principles of acting apply beautifully to writing. So things like you're always telling the truth. What do people want from each other? Who's getting it? Who's not? How do you raise the stakes as high as possible whenever possible? So again, like making Alice be a Harvard professor was raising the stakes as high as possible, right? Because if this is an illness that robs her of her ability to think. Likewise, in Every Note Played for ALS, I made Richard a concert pianist.
Yeah.
And he's a famous concert pianist. So his world is external and worldly, right? All that attention from and the physicality of that fine motor skill. And now he's going to lose both the motor skills. He's going to become paralyzed, but he's also going to be, his world, like Alice, is going to get smaller and smaller. Yeah. He has no audience anymore. So it's like, how cruel can you be in some ways? So a lot of what I learned in acting also is like, you're always expressing honest emotions spontaneously in the moment in response to what happens. This is not an easy thing for us socialized humans to do, right? Like we've all been socialized out of expressing honest emotion, right? Our frontal cortex is like some massive inhibitory projections onto amygdala, right? Like, don't say that. What would your mother say, right? And like, we train our toddlers, don't scream, don't cry, use your words. Like, that's all that inhibitory connections. And as actors, you really want to be disinhibited there and allow yourself to scream when you're angry or cry when you're grief stricken or lust after someone.
Yeah.
Like, you want to show that. And so I would do all of these exercises in acting class to access spontaneous, raw, real emotion. Yeah, yeah. And then I would go home and write, and I could find that writing could be emotionally honest. Yeah.
You know, it's funny because I asked you earlier about, I mentioned Inside the O'Briens and the narrative in it, you know, from this Boston Irish cop. And I was like, yeah, how are you capturing that? But this explains some of it, you know, this sort of ability to feel like, get disinhibited and inhabit the thoughts of somebody else and the acting component of it. Is that is that how that translates over there?
Absolutely, for sure. And I don't just limit the research to the neuroscience and that crowd. I also, my main character is a Boston cop. I better interview some cops. And I came to know a Boston patrolman very well and shadowed him and was in touch with him every day while I was writing.
Very
he
good.
Would send me emails, very lengthy, and texts about like what happened during his shift.
Yeah.
So I got a real inside view there. And I do that for all of my books. So like with More or Less Maddie, the main character has bipolar disorder and she's an aspiring stand-up comedian. And so I knew I had to have some of her stand-up comedy in the book, but I'm not a stand-up comedy writer. So I took a class out of New York City on stand-up comedy writing and I did a 5-minute set. So I could learn how to write comedy for her.
Yeah, yeah.
So that
must have been pretty intimidating.
It was terrifying. but it's so fun. Like what I get to do, like with Every Note Played, my two main characters are trained pianists, so I took piano lessons.
Yeah.
Like, so I just can get a sense of, you know, the action of the keys and what it's like to read notes.
It's
practically
method acting, really. You know, it's
a little bit. Any time I can do research that helps inform the reality, right? So when you're listening to Inside the O'Briens, I believe right now, that hopefully some of what's coming across is that it's vivid, it's specific.
In Every Note Played, right? You already talked about, you know, somebody losing that muscle ability to communicate their music and withdrawing in there. Could you speak a little bit about like your thoughts on the brain and music and why is it so fascinating to us and why it's so important?
Yeah, and this comes up with the Alzheimer's community a lot. Like people will say, you know, my mom can't remember, you know, the conversation 5 minutes ago or what she had for lunch or that she even had lunch, but she can still sing all the words to, you know, the Beatles song. Or if she was a piano player, she can still play from memory all these songs. So all of this music from decades ago, every word, how can that happen? So one of the reasons it happens is because those memories are older, Alzheimer's hasn't wreaked havoc on that circuitry yet. So Alzheimer's begins to invade the synapses that encode our recent memories, our most recent personal history first. And it sort of goes back like layers of an onion. So they're safe for longer to begin with. But then music is also very deeply and richly encoded in our brains. So one is we often learn music, we often overlearn it. So a lot of the songs, I think right now, like I'm a big Swiftie and my daughters are as well. And we listen to Taylor Swift's music over and over
That's true. I mean, so for thousands of exposures to these
thousands
songs.
Thousands of exposures. So
what else would you learn
it past 100%.
Yeah.
Right. And so whenever if you're studying for an exam and you're like, okay, I know all the vocabulary words cold, learn it like even past 100% and travel those neural pathways even more. Yeah. The more you
embed it,
the more
you
travel those neural
yeah.
pathways, the stronger they are.
Right.
So they've been traveled a lot. They're super strong, but they're also connected to a lot of other things. So a lot of songs that are meaningful for us, like, you know, again, if we go to the woman with Alzheimer's, like the song that she danced to at her wedding, or that was popular on the radio when she first started dating her husband, or when she got her first job, or it reminds her of these other things, right?
Yeah.
It reminds her of a time of life. And so that time of life then can become activated and that's connected to the neural circuit of that song. And then for someone with Alzheimer's, the song might be a way in to get them to reminisce about a time in life that seemingly
unhook other things
locked away.
Yeah, right.
And oh, she can't talk about anything.
Yeah.
And now the song might be a way in.
And there's real promise in music as a therapeutic approach in these diseases, neurodegenerative diseases. So I often think about smells. Everybody knows this, you know, the smell of your granny's cooking or whatever.
Yep.
And
yep.
I love the part where, you know, if you think about the olfactory system, right through the perforant pathway into the hippocampus, it doesn't go anyplace else. It doesn't meander around.
That
it goes right in. So old.
Connection.
Yeah.
It's a very old, powerful pathway.
Yeah.
And so, right, that's why, you know, you walk into an elevator and someone's wearing Obsession by Calvin Klein and like the person you dated in high school wore that and you like haven't thought about that person in 40, 50 years.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, like, you know, that person, the memories of that person and that time in high school come flooding back. Right.
Absolutely.
So quick. That's associated with that smell. That's part of that neural circuit or those neural circuits that can reactivate that memory.
Right. So you've tackled Alzheimer's disease, Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, Huntington's and bipolar.
Yeah.
Would you characterize any of them as more difficult than the others, more difficult to enter into? Or is there a paradigm there? You have an approach to all of them.
I do have the approach, right?
Yeah.
Read everything. So that when I contact the thought leaders, the scientists, the clinicians, I'm not asking them questions that I could have already just found myself.
Yeah.
And then I contact people who live with it and their families. And it's not just clinicians, it's speech pathologists, OT, PT, genetic counselors, anyone who touches that patient, psychiatrist, psychologist. Some of them are harder than others. I wrote a book on autism and I wrote it. One of the perspectives was about a boy. The book is about a boy with autism who has nonverbal, who's very profoundly affected. So on that end of the spectrum. And I wanted to write some of the book in his voice, in his point of view. I'm trying to give voice to a voiceless child and sort of how is his brain organized and how does he perceive the world? And that was a bit tricky.
Right, because it is very different from your own experience. I suppose at some level, if you say take something like Alzheimer's disease, we all have at least experience of forgetting things and being a bit panicked about it and that. So there's some piece of it that's part of our own experience.
Well, right. And when I interviewed folks who have Alzheimer's, like it's really only end-stage Alzheimer's or later-stage Alzheimer's that I'm going to have to guess, like, what was my grandmother feeling? Right. What is someone like her feeling? Right. But all the other stages, like I have a friend, Greg O'Brien, who has Alzheimer's. He's had it for over a decade. Wow. And he could still chat about what it feels like. He'll, there was one day we met up for coffee and he came into the coffee shop and he was his clothes were all wet. I gave him a hug. He's drenched. I'm like, Greg, what's going on here?
Yeah.
And he could talk about what happened. He's like, well, his wife wasn't home and he was doing laundry and he went to go get the laundry out of the dryer and all the clothes were still wet and his brain wouldn't tell him how the dryer works.
Right.
Couldn't figure that out. And then his brain also couldn't come up with a new plan to go get dry clothes from the closet.
Yeah,
so he dressed in the wet clothes.
Goodness me.
Yeah. So that's so people can tell me that.
You get a real insight there.
With the nonverbal autism, I had to do a little bit of sort of puzzle solving where the folks that I interviewed who have autism were verbal.
Yeah.
And then the kids who are nonverbal, I had to interview their parents and observe. Right. So it was a little trickier. And neuroscience wise, I wrote that book in 2010, 2011. Like if I went to my principles of neuroscience textbook from, the 90s when I was at Harvard and you go into the index and look up autism under A, it's not in there.
Right.
So we know so little about the neuroscience of autism compared to something like Alzheimer's or Huntington's. So that one felt a
big problem in autism research is that we do in some ways, maybe it's a parallel. We've studied high functioning folks on the autism spectrum. Why? Because we can.
Yeah.
And there's been, I think it's 95% of the research is on folks who actually speak and are relatively fine. And and the nonverbal folks, we don't do much work in. And there's an effort to try and change that, obviously, now. But it's not easy to do the work.
Yeah. And I would say the newest one, More or Less Maddie, is the only book and subject so far that is classified as a mental illness as opposed to just a neurological condition or a neurological disease. And sort of it was a different, again, sort of less neuroscience. We don't understand the neurobiology, the etiology of this illness very well at all. And so it's in the hands of psychiatry.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a bit of a different approach for what I usually do.
You want to paint these pictures of these people with all their complexity, and you also want to steer clear of stereotypes and pigeonholing folks and that. How is that? That's a delicate balance, is it? Or a bit of a dance? And how do you work on that? How do you guard against that?
Yeah, I think to be intentional about it. Right. So again, I am not writing from a space of like, well, I've read some things and I've watched some movies where there are characters who have this and now I'm ready to go. Like I talk to a lot of people who live with this and their loved ones. And I think that accomplishes a couple of things. One, these conversations, and they're ongoing. It's not like, oh, we chat for an hour and then I never see them again. It's like we regularly get back in touch. And like for the folks with ALS, I was just going to their houses or going to their assisted living where they are. These conversations are really intimate, right? These people are sharing like what their biggest fears are, what they regret, what they hope for. Like we're talking about like how do you get dressed, or like what happens when your brain lets you down and it doesn't tell you the truth about what your world, or like just like we're talking about really intimate things, and that lends to like intimacy in a relationship. Mm-hmm. It's like. When you get to know people day to day, or your conversations day to day with people that you see on the street, hey, how are you doing? You good? The kid's good. I'm good. Are you good? It can be that.
Right.
And the conversations I'm having, by the nature of like what we've agreed to, is they're saying, I'm going to help you.
Yeah.
And by the way, with what limited time I have, which is so humbling, right? And
yeah,
it's like
right.
we all have limited
time.
I'm going to
give some of it to
but
you.
Yeah, that they're going to give some of it to me.
It's pretty profound. Yeah.
Like,
Yeah.
So the conversations are just dropping into a very real place.
Yeah.
And so I feel enormous responsibility to they're entrusting me with that information to use it respectfully.
Right.
So I am going to make sure to the best of my ability that I am telling the truth in a respectful and dignified way. So I'm not going to over-dramatize. I'm not going to romanticize. I'm not going to I'm not going to stereotype. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because it's like the other thing is, it's like I'm not, it's unflinchingly going to show you the dark sides of these things. But also people don't live the tragedy of their diagnosis 24/7, right? Yeah. It's not like the Grim Reaper is just like always there and it's always, you know, awful and tragic. Like people get diagnosed with some of these things and they get dialed in really clear as to what matters. Like their priorities suddenly become crystal clear. And a lot of folks were living incredibly inspiring lives, in cases like ALS, like at the end of life.
Yeah.
Really beautiful, last beautiful year of life. And you
it brings focus.
So it's, so I'm not afraid of showing that either. Like, and it's important. And I think that there's, with all of the books, there are these seeds of hope. Mm-hmm. There is, what people want to leave behind, what their legacy is. There's the hope for like, this won't happen to my kids, that science will figure this out and we can do better.
Of course. Yeah.
So that's usually in there too.
Do you, we also spoke earlier on about Oliver Sacks and how he was an inspiration, the man who mistook his wife for a hat. Yeah. What I didn't mention to you was actually, I used to teach undergraduate biopsych in Neuchâtel at Iona College, and my textbook was The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, because it was the way to get, those little narrative stories would really capture the imagination of youngsters who were intimidated by going into a class about, what was essentially neuroscience 101. And they were mostly psychology students, so they'd be a bit scared of the molecular biology. But what I found amazing about that was that those stories really tweak their interest, and then you could sort of back into more complicated material and they really wanted to know then, because they had identified
it was humanized.
It was humanized,
right? It's not just about the disease and the molecular parts of understanding that. It's the human experience. Mm-hmm. Like, whoa, that's fascinating. So, I was 19 years old when I read The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. And there's a 3-page story. So for those who don't know, this book is it's nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like a collection of short stories, but they're true, about interesting neurological patients.
Yeah.
There's, I believe, a 3-page story in there about a man with left neglect.
Yep. Right.
And
he throws his leg out of the bed.
He throws his leg out of the bed. He thinks a nurse is playing a sick joke on him. Yeah. He's like stolen a leg from the morgue.
Doesn't realize only, his own leg is his.
It belongs to him, but he doesn't know, and he goes to throw it out and he falls out of bed every night. End of story. 19 years old, I'm like, but what happens to him?
Yep.
Like, does he go home, or is he in the hospital forever? Like, how do you walk through a whole world if your brain is only aware of half of it? That has stayed with me for decades.
Yeah, yeah.
My second book is Left Neglected. I wrote about someone with left neglect.
Oh, I didn't realize.
To answer that question.
Yeah. Oh, goodness.
Yeah, so it began with that 3-page story in A Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat by Oliver Sacks. I'm like, I want to know more. So, I got to know a lot of people who have it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, talk about a fun little writing puzzle. I started that book in third person, and I didn't like how it felt. I went back and started it again in first person. I'm like, ooh, this is more immediate. I like this better. Right. But oh no, I've just created an interesting dilemma, because at times it's going to get tricky, because I'm telling it from her point of view, but she has unilateral neglect.
Right. Or so you have to pretend like half the world doesn't exist now.
So, well, she's only aware of the right side of things, but how can I communicate the fact that she's not aware of what she's unaware
of.
That's
right,
right? Anosognosia. But how am I going to communicate to the reader that there's something there that she's not aware of?
Right.
So there were ways to do it, but it was like a fascinating puzzle to solve in sort of the literary space.
That's absolutely outstanding. I know too, we would often think of like the stuff that Oliver did as a little bit sort of, a little bit silly, a little bit twee. But what we saw was that it drew people in, and it made partners of our public, and this business of how to communicate what are often very complicated systems and circuitry, and you do a beautiful job of it. Obviously, this is a great gift of yours. Is super important, right? Because we work for the people. Scientists work for the public. Do you see a role for these kinds of narrative structures and medicine, and maybe this humanities approach in medicine? Should we be teaching docs and scientists to speak in this language as well?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so one of the great joys, and I learned this today in the book signing line from a couple of people, more than that, is that my books get used in undergrad.
Fantastic.
They get used in nursing school, med school, OTPT, speech pathology. My daughter, who has a master's in social work, they were required to read Still Alice for one of her classes. So yeah, I think that it absolutely helps them recognize and remember the lived experience of the patient,
right,
and how confusing it can be for them. Like, you know, the people show up to the doctor's office and that power differential can feel very intimidating, and just what they might have been experiencing in the 6 months since they were in here last just humanizes it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you have one up next? Do you have another one they're thinking about tackling?
Yeah. Yeah. So I am, I'm going to go nonfiction again.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And so I wrote one nonfiction book about memory. How do we remember? Why do we forget? Because as I had been traveling the world using Still Alice as a vehicle for conversation to understand,
right,
Alzheimer's, like without fail, after every talk, someone would wait at the end of the book signing line, or a woman would follow me into the ladies' room and just pepper me with, okay, so I'm always forgetting people's names, and yeah, I walk into rooms and I don't know why I went in there, and I have to write down my entire to-do list or I'll forget to do what I'm supposed to do, and I can never remember where I put my glasses, and half the time they're on my head. Do I have Alzheimer's? And so I was, every time I could say, oh no, everything that you're bringing to me is a normal,
it's the common, it's experience, yeah,
it's normal forgetting. Like, this is the price of playing poker as a human. Like, we're not designed to remember everything. And so I'd explain why those things happen, see the relief wash over them.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all right, I got to stop helping one person at a time in the ladies' room and write this down. Similarly, I think one of the other big things the general public is really struggling with and worrying about unnecessarily because they don't understand it is attention.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I want to write a nonfiction book to help folks understand, what does your brain need to pay attention to something, to sustain attention on something?
Mm-hmm.
What is the cost of being distracted? What distracts us? When is it good to let your attention go and let your mind wander? Like, to understand, just like in Remember, I'm like, you know, we tend to villainize forgetting. Like, remembering is the good guy, forgetting is the bad guy. And it's not the case. Like, we need to forget certain things.
Yeah, absolutely.
And likewise, we don't always want to be paying attention. Sometimes it's good to let our minds relax its focus. So I want to write about attention. Next is nonfiction. And then the next novel I want to write about is about alcohol abuse and Korsakoff syndrome.
Ah, of course. Ah. Yeah. So people won't know exactly what Korsakoff syndrome is. This is
like a real
form of memory loss. Yeah.
So I want to write about that. And then the producer who did Still Alice and another producer have teamed up and have asked me to write a dramedy about menopause.
Oh, very
and
good.
I said yes to
all
that.
The way. Yeah.
So that's what's
fantastic.
On deck.
Yeah. I have a million questions, and I could sit here all day. It would be criminal if I didn't ask you this last one question, which is because people want to know what are you reading and what's your favorite? Give us is it evil?
Okay, I'm always reading a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm usually reading nonfiction and fiction. I always have an audio book going and a physical paper book.
Yep.
One of my most recent favorites is James by Percival Everett. I loved it.
Okay.
That's a genius book. What else? I'm reading a 1500 page textbook on attention right now. What else am I doing? What did I just say? I just finished Atmosphere by Taylor Jenkins Reid.
So that's a must read.
I loved it. Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. Quick advice. Last thing I'll ask you. You have your seven things to do to guard against Alzheimer's disease and neurodegeneration. The seven sort of keys to a life of good memory, or that. What are those? Will you run through them?
Yes. Yeah. But it's also to keep a healthy brain today. It's not just about like preventing and reducing your risk of Alzheimer's in the future. It actually is going to improve the health of your brain today. So they overlap. All right. So the seven things.
Yeah.
You want 7 to 9 hours of sleep a night. You want to exercise daily. You want to eat from the Mediterranean or mind menu of foods. You want to reduce your reactivity to chronic stress. You want to learn new things. You want to stay socially engaged, and you want to make sure that you can hear what I'm saying.
That's right. Well, thank you very much. You heard it here. Thank you for that great advice. Thanks for being here at the University of Rochester. It's an absolute pleasure to have you, Lisa.
So much fun. Thank you so much, John.